Awesome.
Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers for including me. I hate to be the last talk before lunch, since I'm sure all of you are thinking about lunch, given the plethora of eating facilities near our housing. So I'm going to talk about two very simple problems. Actually, they're not so simple. Some of you have heard this talk before, like Sabir. This work was done with several people. One was an undergraduate at Illinois who is now at MIT, Charlie Kane, who has been involved in a sort of interesting role, Brandon Langley. So the first part was done with Charlie and Kiran. The second part was done with my student Brandon and a string theory postdoc at Penn State. So I'm not a string theorist, and I'm not going to convince you that I am. I'm a solid-state physicist who is trying to do some things with your tools. Okay, so the reason why I'm trying to do some things with your tools is that Fermi-liquid theory breaks down, and if you take this seriously, you have to be very creative if you're going to be honest. Okay, so I mean, there are ways of hiding behind the problem, but ultimately you'll just get yourself frustrated if you don't face up to the problem. Okay, so the key thing that leads to the breakdown of Fermi liquid theory, there's certainly the strange metal, but in the pseudogap regime, I'm just going to start with the experiment that I'm really going to focus on sharply in this talk, and that is if you shine light on this system, what you see is a set of excitations. These are pole-like excitations, and this surface does not close in momentum space. So for string theorists, this is momentum, kx, ky. This is the first quarter of the Brillouin zone. And the important thing is the topology here. It doesn't form a closed surface. And the fact that it doesn't form a closed surface is the origin of this term, Fermi arc. Now, this is a weird phenomenon. This is a weird phenomenon because typically, if you are probing a band using ARPIS, the band has to cross the chemical potential at least twice. And if it does cross twice, which would be this point here, which would be these points over here, you'd form a closed surface. You don't see a closed surface. Now, if these correspond to pole-like excitations, the fact that it doesn't cross here indicates that there's a problem. And the problem it poses is this. If these are poles, and this is a pole, the real part of the green function is one sign for momenta smaller than this one, and it's another sign for momenta bigger than this. And it's the real part of the green function has to change sign across this pole. Similarly here, the real part of the green function is one sign here, the other sign over here. Now consider a path which goes through this and comes back not through any of these poles. How are you going to maintain the sign change without encountering a pole? Here, there's only one answer. You have to cross a zero. Now, which means that you cannot understand Fermi arcs unless you have zeros. And it's zeros in the sense that the determinant of the green function is equal to zero. Now, where are these zeros? Well, the zeros could either be here, or they could be somewhere on the backside. We have no idea where they could be. But they have to be someplace to supplement the lack of a sign change where you have the poles. Now, it's because of this that those who are trying to understand Fermi arcs in the solid-state community have, and some of them are listed right here, have stated that the real way you understand Luttinger's theorem is that you say that the total particle density is equal to some combination of zeros plus poles. Now, before I look at this more sharply, let's just first see what a zero really is.
So how well do we understand experimentally that it's really an arc, rather than, say, this the other side of Fermi surface you might not have sensitively seen?
Okay, so I'm going to answer that question somewhat cynically. There's very little that the community agrees upon. This is one of the things they do agree upon. Okay? It's an arc. Okay? So I'm not going to worry about that anymore. There are enough things to worry about here. This is not one of them. Okay, so what are zeros? Okay? And are they, like poles, conserved? Okay, so to understand zeros, let's look and see what was in Mott's head when he was looking at nickel oxide. Now, nickel oxide is a partially filled band, and hence there's a problem if it's an insulator. You can't get there by looking at band theory. So Mott had the brilliant idea that, in fact, electrons are hopping around here, and what actually makes them insulate is the fact that it might cost a finite amount of energy when you put two of them in the same cell. And if this energy is large enough, perhaps the imaginary part of the single particle green function looks like this. Or it looks like this in a very particular way. You have split the band into two places, into two pieces where the spectral weight is separated in energy, but you've done so without changing the size of the Brillouin zone. Now, this is an extremely controversial statement. At least it's controversial to those who are right-wingers, of which there are many in our field. And but I'm not going to worry about that right now. Okay, so the Mott problem then. Okay, so this is all backwards. Right, so what I want to do is just take this spectral function that Mott suggests, divide by omega, and I want to construct the real part of the green function. And because the numerator is entirely positive, the denominator is going to determine really what the value is. Now, from minus infinity to zero, you have one sign. From zero to infinity, you have another sign. Hence, you can, in fact, engineer this thing to be equal to zero. So when you say that you have a zero of the green function, the really difficult part getting to be zero is the real part, especially in this setting. So, and it's not just one component, it's really the determinant of the green function. In mean field type theories, it's really just one component, and it's just a product of resolvents, and you can never get it to be equal to zero.
Usually, when you're talking about zeros in a metal, you
can't get zeros in a metal, Sabir.
Exactly, so then why even talk about it?
Because I'm trying to tell you where zeros came from in the first place. They came from the Mott problem. Okay? Okay. There is life beyond metals, Sabir. Okay? Okay, so the determinant of the real part is equal to zero. And that, in fact, entails all of the physics that I call Mottness. All of the connection between high and low energies and the difficulty in even defining this thing called a Mott gap comes about entirely because this thing is equal to zero. Okay, and this is not in mean field theories. Okay, so let's look then at the two ways in which we get sign changes. The two ways in which we get sign changes is either zeros or poles. Now, the reason I'm talking about zeros is that both of them come into this thing that everyone loves to quote Luttinger's theorem. And the reason it comes in is because if you look at what you reduce the particle density to, according to Luttinger, is something which just involves the singularities of log g. And log g is singular whenever g is infinity or zero. And the theorem at this level makes no distinction between the mechanism by which the singularities of log g obtain. And hence, as a result, the actual statement then of the particle density is that you have to sum over the locus of points in momentum space wherever the real part of the green function is positive. And that can happen either by encountering a zero or a pole. So since zeros correspond to the Mott problem and poles correspond to Fermi liquids, this formulation of Luttinger's theorem would have you believe that this would give you the correct filling, regardless of whether or not your system is in this extreme case of a Mott insulator, or in this more friendly case of a Fermi liquid. Now, this is the belief in the field, and it sort of became more clearly planted in people's heads that this is really what Luttinger had entailed by a paper by Zielaschinsky, which looked at this proof again and stated very clearly that this proof applies to everything. And if it doesn't apply, it's because you didn't go and include the zeros. So the question I want to ask is this statement correct? Because if it is, then it's really giving us a much more general way of interpreting the charge density than just counting poles, which we all know are quasi-particles. So is this correct? So let me just give you a way of doing a simple calculation which only has zeros, something Sibir doesn't like, which only has zeros, and I want to show you that you get the correct particle density. So here's my Hamiltonian. It's very simple. I have sites which have, I'll put the chemical potential in the middle. So I have two kinds of sites. They're split by an energy U, and hence there's just a repulsion anytime you put two on the same site, and there's no hopping. Now, if I want to be in the Mott limit, so I need to be at a filling corresponding to less than the total number of particles I can have in the system, which is just two in this case. So if I apply Luttinger's theorem to this system and however I'm going to do that, I should end up with a filling of one. So I'm going to put the chemical potential in the middle. This will mean that this state will be energy minus U over 2. This one will be at energy U over 2. The green function here is very simple. It's just the resolvent for this state plus the energy for that state. And it's a sum because of the fact that we split the two bands, but we haven't changed any index in the system. So the green function just looks like this. And if you evaluate this at omega equals 0, this in fact is equal to 0, which is excellent, because then the number of particles in the system is 2 theta of 0, which is just equal to 1. And that gives you the correct result. Now, there's something sort of funny going on here. The system is incompressible. So I could put the chemical potential anywhere between here and there. And if it is, I haven't changed the filling. And if this is really a theorem in the mathematical sense, I shouldn't at all change the number of particles in the system. Well, let's see if that's true. So this was pointed out by Rosh in 2007 when several of us started thinking about zeros. And this is the form of the green function when you include the chemical potential. Now note, the denominator is negative for any value of mu between here and here. So that's the real problem. If you look then at this quantity, let me just plot what this tells you is the density by varying mu between here and there. Well, if I start with mu up here, this denominator is negative, this is positive, this entire thing is entirely negative, the density is 0. And then it's 1 right here in the middle, and then it's 2 when you're down here. So this is clearly wrong, because I haven't changed the filling in going between here and here, but I've changed it according to my application of what I think Luttinger's theorem is telling me.
This is a case of the ground state degeneracy, and the answer really at finite temperature.
That's not the point.
Okay.
What is the point here is, so I will come to that, Sibir. I'm not being dismissive, but a criticism that was raised among many of them was the fact that this ambiguity in what the chemical potential is really sort of artificial, because what you really should be doing is working with the chemical potential you have at finite temperature and extrapolating that down to T equals 0. And that will uniquely fix the chemical potential to be halfway between these two bands, and you'll always end up with the conclusion that in fact n is equal to 1. Okay, so let's accept that then, that the way you apply this, including zeros in the particle count, is to work with the chemical potential that you extrapolate down from finite temperature down to T equals 0. Okay, so does this fix all the problems?
So this is related to the asymptotic structure of the asymptotic behavior of the green function?
Yes, it's related entirely to the eigenvalues of the green function.
So if you don't take that limit, then you are saying the asymptotic behavior is not right.
Right, absolutely. So what I'm saying is there's a way then in which we think the asymptotic behavior should be taken. Let's take that and let's see now if this fixes including zeros in the particle count. Okay, is everyone clear what I'm trying to do? Okay, so does this solve all the problems? The answer is no. And here's the reason why. So what I want to do is come up with a model in which you go and do everything right, and Luttinger's theorem still fails, and any criticism you could possibly raise is irrelevant. Okay, so here is the model I'm going to, I've laid down the gauntlet, okay? I'm ready to go to battle with this one. Okay, so here you go, okay? Here's the model. I want to have a model with zeros, so I simply turn off the hopping. Gary, can I use your pointer? Mine,
you have spinless electrons?
I'll get to it, Sabir. It's better than that. In fact, I don't need the pointer for this. Okay, does yours still work? Yes, okay. So mine just uses batteries like crazy. But I want to have n flavors of electrons in every site. Okay? Okay. So here's my basic Hamiltonian. It's an SUN model. And this is the basic Hamiltonian. And there's no hopping. I've chosen this Hamiltonian for two particular reasons. One, it gets rid of an artificial truth that has to be there for Luttinger to apply. And two, I can solve this problem exactly. Okay, so here's just what each of these represents a different flavor. And so, you know, there's n equal 2 would just be the, you know, the standard spinful case, and just this is. So here are what the energy levels look like. Okay, I can go and calculate the single particle green function for this problem exactly. And let me just point to what is going on for n equals 3. N equals 3, there are four different energy levels corresponding to the three particles I can have on a site. Here is none, and they go from here. If I were to look at the spectral function, in other words, the function that tells me of a particle addition and removal, I have a peak going from here to there, that's this one, that's this energy difference, and one from here to there, that's this, and from here to here, that's this state, that's this peak right there. Okay, now I want to work in the Mott limit, which I have partial filling. So partial filling, only these two levels are occupied. Extrapolating from finite temperature down to T equals zero would place the chemical potential halfway between here and there. So that's the correct way of doing the asymptotics. Now, what you note is that in this case, if
you don't have partial symmetry,
just work out the formula. It turns out it's right here.
Ignore the lower level, you mean?
I want two levels to be occupied.
Yes.
Okay.
And they both have some thermal formula.
Right. The exact chemical potential at finite temperature for this filling is right there. Okay? No, that's exactly the point. If particle hole symmetry is important in getting the count right, we've clearly broken it. And that's why we went to this. Okay? Now, so let's go and work out the Luttinger theorem. The green function can be calculated exactly. Depends on some stuff which doesn't change sign and some stuff which does. The Luttinger count is exactly this formula right here. So it's n, it's a big n, theta of 2n minus small n. Minus big n. Okay, now, I need to hurry up. Okay, so this function can only be 0, 1, or 1 half. Consider the case of small n equals 2 and big n equals 3. This theorem is telling you that 2 is equal to 3, which is clearly wrong. And in fact, it's much more wrong than that. Anytime this is even and this is odd, there's no solution to this equation. Now, let's get to Sabir's question. This is fine, but this problem has a huge ground state degeneracy. And Luttinger's theorem, as it's traditionally applied, typically is true only for a non-degenerate system. So let me now lift the degeneracy by keeping the SUN symmetry intact. And I can go and do that, and here's the result. Here's what the green function looks like. So what I want to do is substitute into here a pure state, one in which I've picked out a particular state the system is in, so it's not in this huge degenerate soup anymore. Okay? But I want to do that asymptotically as I've lifted the degeneracy by a small perturbation t. So which means I still know what these things look like. There are two states, basically one over omega, one over u. These can be pulled outside this. I can do this, and here is what I end up with. Now, this quantity right here is just a trace of this quantity with this non-degenerate state, this u0 right here. Now, the point of it is this quantity is still purely, it's purely diagonal, but all of these entries are non-zero. In fact, they're all equal. Because lifting the degeneracy doesn't mean that I have turned on a magnetic field, and hence only one of these isospin states is relevant. All of them are still there. So as long as this remains off diagonal, the zeros are in fact in the wrong place. And as a result, the claim of the degeneracy does not matter. And as a result, you'll still end up with this conclusion that the Luttinger theorem fails if you just include zeros. I mean, in this case of zeros. Okay, so what went wrong? I mean, it's not as if, you know, this was done by serious people, so what went wrong? If you're going to get the Luttinger count, sorry, if you're going to get a green function which is infinite, and it's the determinant which is now equal to zero, if you're going to get sigma infinite, it's going to tell you that the lifetime of a particle is going to vanish. Now, remember what Landau said. It's to include something as a particle, it has to be that this is less than epsilon p. Well, it's clearly not going to be the case if this thing is diverging. And what I mean by diverging, I mean diverging at the chemical potential. It's going to a delta function, so it's really infinite. And as a result, these things are not particles. Okay, now, more mathematically, what actually went wrong is the following. If you look at this integral, this is the thing that you have to show is a complete integral, differential for the particle count to reduce to just the singularities of log g, which means you have to be able to construct what's called the Luttinger-Ward functional. This integral is just thing here with sigma. Well, if sigma diverges, you can't go and do this integral. If you can't go and do the integral, you can't complete the proof of Luttinger's theorem, which means there is no theorem, okay? And there's nothing you can do about it, because there's no way at the very beginning of distinguishing between zeros and poles. Each of them contribute equally to the singularities of log g. Now, this, of course, might not make you feel very good, but that's fine. This statement is only true when you have poles. But I claim that this is sort of trivial, because this is only, you only have poles if you have a Gaussian fixed point, but for that, you already know that the renormalizations of the interactions are towards the Fermi surface, in which case this statement is really a tautology. So I agree with Subir's statement that if you have poles, of course you have this, but you don't need a theorem for that. Okay, so is there an experimental for the violation of Luttinger's theorem? Sorry, there's no theorem. For whatever it was, okay, that we...
I don't think Luttinger ever talked about zeros. Maybe you should call it the Jaroszynski kind of Luttinger theorem. Luttinger never talked about zeros.
The result he ended up with...
No, but he never mentioned zeros.
Well, he didn't know about them. But we're doing math here,
they
so...
They exist.
No, of course they exist. They certainly exist in the Mott problem. Okay? Okay, so let's, Subir, if you have a Fermi arc, you have to have zeros. And hence, it's inescapable if that's the experimental fact. So let's look now at the experiments in the Fermi arc regime, and let's try to estimate what the volume is that you somehow surround by all of these, by this arc structure. And that's what this quantity is experimentally, this is being extracted experimentally, and that's compared with the nominal value of what x is, and x is known absolutely for LSCO, and those are these points, and these points are BISCO. As you see, these points are not on this line, and the error bars is 0.02. So there's no way of really squaring these results. Am I supposed to finish at 12:15? 12:30. Okay, great. I was going to say couldn't give the second half of my talk. 12:25. Okay, I'll try to be try to be swift here. Okay. So, look, this doesn't agree. So, now you might say this is not a direct test of whether or not this is an agreement of Luttridge's theorem or not. But what it's really telling you is that when you remove a k-state, when you remove a hole, you're not removing one k-state.
What is the important thing? You have this arc.
That's right. So there are two ways in which this is done, okay? For LISCO, which is the Stanford's group's experiments, these purple or blue, whatever they are, they just measure kf, and then they go and measure this interior region right here.
But they only have an arc.
I know, that's right. They only have an arc. In fact, they don't know where the zeros are, so they really cannot go and do this. Okay? And in fact, what these people do is even something worse. What they do, since they don't have an arc and they have no idea where the zeros are, they assume the zeros are on the backside of the arc, and they close it symmetrically according to the Yang Rice Zhang proposal. And they look at that area, you know, which is as good as any, since you have no idea where the zeros are. And they call that, and from that they extract out what XFS is.
What is the systematic error?
So the systematic error bar is the only thing that's really relevant here. In these points, it's less than 0.02.
And if you can't see it.
No. Sorry. In.
You can't see the backside of.
Right. Okay. So right. Absolutely. Fine.
I'm just curious. If I don't see the backside of.
If you don't see the backside, then you really have no idea what you're doing, okay? Okay, so. Right. So I at this point, you would say it's unclear how to interpret this lack of disagreement here. This lack of agreement. Sorry. Okay. So it might be telling you this. I think this is going to be true regardless, because you can't understand arcs unless you have zeros. And I've just proven that there is no way of getting the particle count right when you have zeros. Okay. And there's no way of interpreting zeros as an inverse quantity, namely something else that has a pole, and I will get to that. Okay, so it means if you're going to count particles in your system, it means that there's some charge stuff that has no interpretation in terms of particles. Now, this charge stuff is emerging because there's an infinite self-energy. So what I want to do right now is just sort of retool and figure out how to interpret stuff that has an infinite self-energy. Well, it's clearly not adiabatically connected to a Fermi liquid. And if it's not, it's controlled by some new fixed point. So all fixed points have scale invariance. So I just want to impose scale invariance on stuff that has an infinite self-energy to try to understand what is the non-trivial IR dynamics that is emerging. OK, so I claim there's only one answer here. And it's the unparticle stuff that Howard Georgi and everyone else who is doing conformal field theory, so they can all claim credit for this, has been doing. OK, so here's a way of understanding unparticles. So if you have just a standard free field theory with a mass, this breaks scale invariance. This can be seen by just scaling this and this, and there's no way of scaling these in the same way so that these powers match up. Okay, now, you can, however, make a Lagrangian with a mass scale invariant if you interpret this field at a particular value of mass. And you, in fact, were to integrate over all mass. So if you now just go and scale, you'll end up with an m squared over lambda squared here. And you can just treat that as the new integration variable. And in fact, your system is now scale invariant. So you've restored scale invariance in a theory that patently didn't have it. But since you're now treating this as a theory with all possible mass, the system now is scale invariant. And what's underlying this is not a particle description. These are what has been called unparticles. Now, the propagator here is just the standard propagator integrated with this weight coefficient. And the du is the scaling dimension of the unparticle field. And this has been interpreted as in the following way. If you look at the propagator for n massless particles, it also looks like this. It looks very similar to the unparticle form. And what has been pointed out is that if you take this analogy seriously, then you should really interpret unparticles as a fractional number of massless particles. So really composite excitations with a fractional number of massless particles. Now, the case I'm interested in is going all the way from the Fermi liquid to the case of zeros by simply cranking up what you can think about du as an anomalous dimension, or just this exponent, the scaling dimension of the unparticle field. OK, so in other words, du bigger than 2. And if that is the case, then your propagator, this branch cut, will be in the numerator, and you'll have zeros. OK. Now, there is no simple particle interpretation here to zeros. If there were, if you simply made this superposition, this and this would have the same particle content. And only if you make this statement can you interpret the propagator in the unparticle case in this Gaussian type of theory. But this statement is, in fact, wrong, as pointed out by several people, Howard most notably. OK, so what is du? Is there any way of fixing this scaling dimension du? OK, so what really is the summation over mass? The summation over mass is really a summation over energy, which means that underlying this, this continuous mass formalism for unparticles should really be an ADS-type construction. And this has been pointed out. Misha Stepanov and Turning. They said, look, this looks an awful lot like the ADS action with a mass just given by this quantity right here. But this is just an analogy, and du still remains sort of a free parameter. Now, if you really are going to make the argument that this looks like ADS, then m has to be this extra dimension. So let's try and do that exactly. OK, so can we do something more exact? So what we did is we simply took this unparticle action and just replaced m with 1 over length. Now, what this will do is that it's going to now replace this ADS mass with 1 over r squared on the right-hand side, which means we've effectively fixed the unparticle scaling dimension. Now, if you simply make this substitution and go and do all of the integrals, what you'll end up with is this kind of Lagrangian. Now, each factor of z, you can just subsume into this. And hence, all of this can be just absorbed into the ADS metric. So really underlying this unparticle construction really is an action on ADS. And the unparticle, in fact, lives in 4 plus 2 delta. And the scaling dimension is effectively fixed. So I'm going to use this as my generating functional for unparticles, meaning that I'm going to use this as the way of getting out the propagator that I have that's just governed by scale invariance. Now, there's something else I've done by doing this. I've included dynamics in the z direction, which I don't want. So I have to choose the boundary condition such that I choose a solution that's really largest at the boundary and decaying into the bulk. And that can be done by choosing the correct value for du. So here's how I would construct this. I can easily go and get out the form of the propagator. And du that gives you this decaying solution in the bulk is one which has this value for the exponent, which is bigger than 2, d over 2. So the scaling dimension is fixed. Now, if this is bigger than that, you end up with then that this thing is equal to 0. at zero values of its argument. So on particles, in the ADS construction, naturally describe zeros, which means they naturally describe a system that has a suppressed spectral weight at zero energy. So that's the natural thing that comes out of ADS. Okay, has this been seen before? It in fact has. If you look at what string theory is telling you, and we should believe what string theory tells us since it is the theory, what you find out is that the spectral functions look like this. They don't have Fermi surfaces. They all look like things that have zeros. Because if this is a spectral function, I go and integrate this with 1 over omega, I'll end up with the real part, in fact, a zero. So, and other people have obtained this, but all of this is based on a Lagrangian, which looks like this.
This is the imaginary part of your part. Why is the real part zero?
For the reasons I just mentioned. Just go and construct, using the Cramer's chronic, what the real part would be.
You have some symmetry around.
No. It would, depending on, so you have to integrate from minus infinity. So exactly where you put it is where you put the, you know, where you cut this would actually, but the fact that there's spectral weight here and here implies that there could be a zero in the real part.
But not at the same point, the imaginary part.
Okay, let's come to that. It not necessarily, but I think it will work out in this case. Okay, but my key point here is that this general string construction is giving you something that has a suppression of the spectral weight. And it's being suppressed algebraically. Now, this is just an answer. So what I'm trying to do is understand what this answer is, what's underlying this, and is it similar to this increasing the value of the scaling dimension of the relevant field, the same way the unparticle construction is, giving rise to this vanishing of the spectral weight. Now, the term which is giving rise to all of this physics, and Gubser also has a similar result, is this term right here. This f mu mu nu gamma mu nu term. This is just the Pauli term. Now, the coefficient of this term is just fixed by supersymmetry. And it's fixed to 1/2. So if this is the thing that's really giving rise to this, what I'd like to do is just go and do a theory, a bottom-up theory, with this as my effective Lagrangian, in which I just vary this term, the size of this term. And can I go all the way from Fermi liquid theory to something which has a suppressed spectral weight? Okay, so it turns out we'd actually done that before this came about, but now I'm reinterpreting it in this unparticle way. And so P is just the magnitude of this term. Now, why does this have a possibility of working? Well, it turns out P is coupling to the scaling dimension of this field. If I just expand this around the ADS2 region, this is what I end up with. And this thing, as you see, is entering the mass, which means it's going to enter the scaling dimension. Which means if I make P large enough, according to what my own particle construction is telling me, I should be suppressing the spectral weight at zero energy. OK, so let's see if this works out. So this is the famous result from Hong Liu and the MIT group. Actually, a nice peak here at P equals zero. And I just want to study these results as I crank up P. If I can even change the sign to P, because it's completely unconstrained now by nothing, since it's a bottom-up theory. Okay, so here I have Fermi liquid behaviors. I crank this up even further. I can get marginal Fermi liquid behavior. I can get non-Fermi liquid behavior with some other algebraic power. So notice, this is 1 over the square root of 6, which is less than 1/2. Okay? Now, something magical happens at 1 over the square root of 6. Okay, the string theory result is right here, where you see this algebraic suppression of the spectral weight. Now, if you crank up P even further, what you find is that if there's some criterion you have for what you mean by zero for the spectral weight, you can actually make the spectral weight smaller than that value. And the result you have is indicated right here. The spectral weight can vanish over a finite range of frequency. Now, this, I think, has to be interpreted in the same way the other results were. Namely, that this is not really a gap in the real sense of a gap. It's a gap in sort of the unparticle sense, in which this is really an algebraic type of gap, but there's no real length scale that's being defined here, in the sense that what I really have is I can just define a zero for what I mean by zero measurable spectral weight, and that's where I have this cutoff for the size of this region. Okay, so this is matching up with what we expected from this construction. Okay, I have gone over time. There's several more things that you can do with unparticles. You can go and look at a superconducting instability, and they have certain consequences for the statistics. And my key point is, if I just go through this, since I don't want you to start. Okay, so this is just basically my conclusion that Fermi arcs and zeros and unparticles are intimately tied together. There is no such theorem relating the particle density if you have Fermi arcs, which means there should be, if you could reliably determine what this area was, you'd see each k state wasn't equal to one of these things. And here are some conclusions from this kind of analysis. Okay.
Yeah.
Hi, guys. Hi, Philip. I think you showed post-emission spectra. You skipped them towards the end. You have data showing that at optimal doping, at the anti-nodes, you seem to see bullet and particles.
Did I?
Well, you sort of work in the drip by experimentalists, it's very striking. Like this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, right. So. Right, okay. So this right here, right? So my point here,
yes,
is that if in this what did I do with the pointer? Anyway, I don't know where it is. Sorry, Gary. I don't know. it's now the unpointer. Okay, so the point was these broad features are what is in the pseudo gap, and that's what I'd say is the unparticle. Okay. I know. This point is actually closer there. Okay, but what I'm saying is the generic feature you see in the pseudogap regime where I'm arguing this unparticle stuff is, because just the residual of this Mott gap is that broad stuff. And the moment you undergo a transition where you really do open a gap, that's when you get the sharp spectral features. And the reason why this has such a strange superconducting instability is that unparticle stuff, it's scale invariant, it's unstable to the opening of any gap.
And then there's this long-standing result that the weight of the fast particle peak in the superconductor scales with the superfluid density, which is very weird.
It's
still true. I checked it out with Yu Chen a couple of weeks ago.
So you want to know if we could somehow get that from what we're doing.
Yeah,
okay. That's an excellent point, and we can certainly try to go and do that.
One short question.
Yeah. I'm a little bit confused. Correlators, in general, you have to define them. You have to choose schemes. You have to renormalize if you're doing quantum field theory. And to get dispersion relations, you have to subtract. Now, poles are well-defined despite all of this. Are zeros well-defined in these cases?
Yeah, I don't see why not.
You subtract.
My statement that the unparticle propagator governs the IR physics is not a statement of overall energy scales. It's just a statement about the low-energy physics. So my statement is the non-trivial IR dynamics of strongly correlated systems always has to give you this scale invariant propagator.
That I agree. I'm just wondering whether there is an invariant way of talking about zeros of a correlator.
Okay. Well, zeros and poles are fundamentally different because zeros are not conserved, which is why many people hate them. But they are there if you have a gap that is dynamically generated. It's not there if you have a mean field gap. But a gap that has no sort of symmetry-breaking origin, you have to have. You can only talk about it in the sense of zeros. So ultimately, your real question or worry then is there a field theory for systems which have dynamically generated gaps? I claim there is. I mean, string theory is giving you one. Okay, this ADS, what people have called the ADS2 metal. Okay, and I think that's the way we have to understand the Mott gap. It's really not a gap in any traditional sense. It is a gap in this sense that you have this suppression of the spectral weight below some value you want to call zero.
But in that example, I think as Sophia was asking, it's not clear you have the full Green function zero, right? Only imaginary part is zero.
Right, okay, so I haven't done the analysis. Okay, this worry about Sabir is that somehow the zeros are restrictive because you have to get two equations to magically equal zero. I don't think you really have to worry about too much. Because, okay, what you have to do is an integration from minus infinity up to infinity with some place, you know, reasonably... In fact, you know, Sabir, I'm going to go and do that integral tonight, okay? I'll do that integral because I know I can do it. And I think I'm going to convince you that the ADS2 metal does have a zero. Okay, I think I can because I know this functional form and I think I can do it.
Well, in the ADS2 limit, you have emergent particle whole symmetry. I mean, the point is when you don't have particles.
No. Does this thing look particle whole symmetric to you?
I mean, you know, maybe you have different eyes than I do, but
does that look particle hole symmetric to you?
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay? But the point of it is then, if you place the chemical potential here, okay, remember you're doing an integral from here, and it's 1 over omega. Okay? So this spectral weight is further away from 0 than this is. So I think if you integrate far enough, you are going to match up to get a zero.
There's no mathematical reason that should give you a zero.
Okay.
But zeros are not, okay, so look, it's entirely, whether you have a zero or not is entirely, you just have to go and do it. Okay, I mean, there's no real mathematical.
So, I mean, to summarize, I mean, I agree with you that zeros have nothing to do with letting this zero. So let's just forget about that.
Yeah.
That was your point. All right, so then, the other claim we made in the last slide is that unparticles give you Fermi arcs. Can you summarize why?
So my statement was that if you are trying to understand the low energy physics of Fermi, I didn't say the statement of Fermi. The statement I made was that Fermi arcs imply zeros, and zeros imply unparticles. Okay, that was the logic of the statement. I'm saying you cannot understand Fermi arc phenomenology without understanding zeros, which is why I've spent the last 10 years trying to understand zeros.
There's no way to take a shortcut from Fermi arc to unparticles without talking about zeros. That's what I would like to see.
Now I can. I mean, okay, on some level, I sort of wasted the last 10 years of my life thinking about zeros, but now that I have wasted the last 10 years of my life, I can now just talk about unparticles, okay? Okay, which is what I'm doing now.
Okay.
Okay.